To call to order the February 27th meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee in the Senate, we have two bills. Senator File 1921, Senator Roebling. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I haven't been before your committee yet this session, and so it's a pleasure to be here. I have a bill here today that would help us understand a little more about what's going on inside abortion clinics. And it would ask for clinics to be licensed and then inspected as well. And we would be asking the Department of Health to set up rules to determine how that would be accomplished. So the bill is really rather short and simple. It says that any facility that does 10 or more abortions a month would be required to be licensed and must be open for inspections, and that the Commissioner of Health, their department, would perform those inspections. Data would be kept private, and it also says that no inspection notice would be required, that they could be drop-in inspections. And that is comparable to some of the other facilities that we have throughout the state that are currently licensed by the state for health purposes. We imagine this would be similar to something that we currently have for the ambulatory surgical centers. And currently we do license and inspect those. And of course we have hospitals and nursing homes that are licensed and inspected as well. And we believe that it is also appropriate to license and inspect abortion centers. I know when abortion became legal throughout the United States in 1973, I was a junior in high school, and I remember hearing that one of the reasons people thought it was important to legalize is because there were too many backroom abortions and abortions done in improper conditions, and they wanted to make sure that there was a higher degree of safety. And quite frankly, we don't know if there is or not, because we currently do not have regulations or oversight over those facilities. And so I think it's appropriate that we look at this. This is something I had not been aware of before. I am well aware of the fact that the state licenses and inspects many, many things. We have a small game farm, and the state licenses and inspects our game farm. There's licensing and inspections for numerous areas of operations that we have throughout the state. And so when I became aware that this was not happening with these clinics, I thought it would be appropriate. It's not highly prescriptive of how this would be done. We, again, leave it to rulemaking through the Department of Health.
Thank you, Senator Roebling. And we did have a hearing earlier this year about licensing of various kinds of facilities, and we did have testimony to the effect that these facilities are not currently licensed or inspected, I don't believe, by anyone on a regular basis. Can I ask you, on subdivision one of the bill, 10 or more, what is the is there something about 10 that creates a threshold that if you have less than 10 it doesn't, or what's the reason for the 10?
We just felt that was a level of reasonableness that would be appropriate.
I know you've got a testifier, and I don't know if anybody on the committee has questions of Senator Roebling right now. Otherwise, we can hear testimony from. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, an organization with more than 70,000 member families and more than 200 chapters across the state. We are devoted to the single issue of protecting innocent and vulnerable human life. Almost 40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions, which legalized abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason. Supporters of these decisions were pleased that women would no longer have to engage in dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortions. So how is it that just last year, a Pennsylvania grand jury report was able to stun our nation, pro-life and pro-choice alike, by shedding light on the dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortions that were happening at a clinic there. According to a description of the grand jury report found on the website of the Office of the Attorney General, the Office of the District Attorney in Philadelphia, quote, Gusnell staffed his decrepit and unsanitary clinic entirely with unlicensed personnel, let them practice medicine on unsuspecting patients, unsupervised, and directed them to heavily drug patients in his absence. In addition, he regularly performed abortions beyond the 24-week limit prescribed by law. As a result, viable babies were born. Gusnell killed them by plunging scissors into their spinal cords. He taught his staff to do the same. Dirty, illegal, and unsafe. Dr. Gusnell, the owner of the facility, is now in jail, and many of his former staff members have been charged with and pleaded guilty to various crimes as well. Few people, if any, could argue that this is inappropriate. But the question remains, how could this happen? And more significantly, how can we ensure this never happens in Minnesota? To the best of our knowledge, no abortion facilities in Minnesota come anywhere near the dirty, illegal, and unsafe conditions that were found at the clinic in Pennsylvania. But we believe the state should act to ensure that such conditions never do occur in our state. This can be done by providing common sense licensing and inspection standards for Minnesota facilities that provide 10 or more abortions per month. The legislation before you today would require the Department of Health to promulgate rules to make this a reality by setting minimum standards for such facilities. The state already licenses other similar facilities, including hospitals, outpatient surgical centers, and many more, even facilities that specialize in body art, like tattoos and piercings. Based on data from 2010, this legislation would affect a maximum of just 7 different facilities, which between them perform more than 98% of the more than 11,000 abortions done each year in Minnesota. The purpose of all government regulation is to protect the public by enforcing minimum standards. This legislation asks the Department of Health to determine specifically what these standards would be, with the assumption that the department is more than qualified to draft requirements which would be appropriate when compared to other licensing regulations. To protect the women of the state of Minnesota from the dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortion practices we have seen in other states, we urge you to support Senate File 1921. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Are there questions for the witness? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senators, my question to start out with is, are these inspections that are brought by the department, are they unannounced or announced inspections?
Senator Roebling.
Senator Hall, the legislation calls for the abortion clinics to be available at any time for inspections, so they would not necessarily be announced.
Okay.
And Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, enforces this then?
Senator Roebling?
It would be the Department of Health.
Okay.
Other questions? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, what kind of other facilities does other facilities mean in your bill?
Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that just refers to any other facilities that are providing 10 or more abortions per month.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, what kind of facilities are those?
Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, they typically would be abortion clinics.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, clinic is already in the series that you call out. You have clinic, health center, and other facility. I'm just trying to find out what other facilities are the other facilities.
Mr. Chair, they could be hospitals, although I don't know that we have any hospitals currently performing abortions in Minnesota, but they could be hospitals as well.
Okay. Thank you.
I do want to go back and just ask Senator Roebling if you would be, would you consider a friendly amendment if this committee changed the 10 or more to be nonspecific, just say facilities that perform abortions?
Senator Hahn?
Senator Roebling?
It could be problematic. I would prefer not to change it right now.
Okay. I was just asking the question. It seems to me that there might be a process by which the department would have to figure out how many were occurring in every location, and that in itself might have additional burdens to it that it might be easier to administer if you didn't have to do that. I'm just also wondering about the policy of why 10 requires an inspection but 9 does not. And just
Senator Hahn, Ms. Rao would like to respond to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, currently we have fairly extensive abortion reporting requirements in Minnesota at this time. The Department of Health issues an annual abortion report where physicians and facilities already report the number of abortions that they're doing on an annual basis. From that report, we can see that for many years, basically, there have been 7 different facilities in the state that would qualify as abortion facilities that regularly perform abortions. Outside of those 7, the number of abortions is quite small comparatively. For example, in 2010, there were 116 abortions that were provided outside of those 7 different facilities. And it was a number of different physicians across the state. At least we anticipate that they are across the state and not at any particular location. And so we want to allow physicians, if for some reason they have a reason to do an emergency abortion or something like that, to be allowed to do that without being concerned that they could then, you know, have a problem because they weren't licensed to do it.
Thank you. Senator Roebling, there is a fiscal note. I don't know if that's something that you want to talk about briefly.
Mr. Chair, I just received the fiscal note this morning, and I do have some questions, and I don't know if the department is here, but they are considering this a major rule, and that would mean that it would have to be 50 pages or more of text. And we did look up what the current rules are for outpatient surgical centers, and they're about 15 pages. And we think this would be comparable to that sort of a rule. And we also could use that as a template for how this rule could be developed, because it addresses the same types of things that are related to issues about infection control, staff qualifications and training, anesthesia procedures, disposal of the biologic materials, patient rights, physical plants, sanitary environment, and reportable diseases. And so those are the areas that we would like to address in this rule, and that rule also addresses those similar issues. And it does it in about 15 pages right now. So I need to talk to them and get an understanding of what they thought we meant and what they think it will take, because the first year of the fiscal note is the big one because of the development of the rules. And after that, it is related to the ongoing inspections, and that is a much smaller annual cost of approximately $53,000.
Okay. Is there anyone from the Department of Health that could speak to the fiscal note? Please come forward.
Sure.
And identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hahn, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. The rationale in doing this fiscal note, questions that we had received. I don't know if you've gotten to the second question, Senator Roebling, but one was, why was it this expensive? And then also, it would be, we recommended it out of a general fund because we don't, in rulemaking, have the authority to establish any fees. So that, but that question has been asked, so I'll wait and answer the question at hand, which is the $300,000. And the reason was, yes, there are rules governing various licensing that go on now, but the standards that we held this to was that it would be groundbreaking and that it would be new area of regulation and also the controversy, meaning there would be more than likely public hearing, more time with administrative law judge, more time in the judicial process, not the appeals or anything like that, but just the process itself. So we felt that we have three categories we follow, just streamline it. This would be one that would be a higher cost rule. And that was the justification for the number.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
And there is quite a significant difference between what is considered a major rule or a medium rule and the cost. They considered it the major rule, and it's $286,845. And the medium rule, and then there's a small rule too, is $124,248. And I haven't had much time to digest this, but in comparing it to the rules set for the outpatient surgical centers, which is about 15 pages, I would suspect that it could possibly be considered a medium rule and would have the lesser cost. In addition, I did have an amendment drafted to address the issue that they can't set fees and only we can. But having just become aware of this, I do have the A1 amendment. And what it does is it does set a license fee for the facility, which would recover the costs of their licensing and inspections. However, I have a blank number right now, which we will work to fill in as we move along here. Of course, this will have to come to the Finance Committee to make sure that we have the right figure in there, so we're not overcharging or undercharging, that it would be an appropriate amount for the license.
And Senator Roebling, just so that I'm clear about this, and I know we haven't introduced this amendment unless you'd like to do that right now, but is it your intention that whatever number is filled in there would serve to neutralize the cost of any fiscal note that wherever that may end up? I know you may want to have some further discussion with the department about whatever that number might be, but would that be the intent, to create a fee that would sort of offset any costs that are showing up in a fiscal note? Is that essentially your?
That's correct. We'd like to offset that as much as we can for the annual inspections and licensing.
And what about for the initial rulemaking? Would the fee also be used to offset the cost of that, whatever that might be? Is that contemplated?
That's yet to be determined.
Okay. All right.
But typically we do charge back the institutions for the cost of the inspections and oversight that they have. Right now, for example, the surgical centers are charged $3,700 for a license. And then they have for an Adverse Healthcare Reporting Act fee. So if there's an adverse report, there's a $2,200 fee. And then they have a licensing surcharge fee that is also for the technology that the IT people have put on all of these licenses. So there are ways to recover some of these costs, at least, if not most of them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, if Senator Roebling wants, I will offer the A1 amendment, because I believe that was not.
Senator Roebling, is that your wish to have this amendment adopted?
I would like to have it adopted as a placeholder, that we were going to continue to work on what that number should be, and we would hopefully have that resolved by the time it gets to the Finance Committee.
Senator Fischbach moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Roebling, any other testimony that you have on the bill?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any people in the audience that want to testify? I don't have anyone on the list other than Ms. Rao. I'm not aware of any other testifiers. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, just an observation. When we were discussing the 10 or more terminations, pregnancies in any given month, And when Senator Hand suggested, why don't we just take out the 10 or more, and you said, well, that could be confusing because a whole lot of other ones, one's done here, one's done there. I picture most of those be done at the type of clinic that I go to. It's a physician clinic, which I gather is, from what we heard from the testimony a couple weeks ago, I don't know if you're here for it, from the health department, that that's how these facilities are regulated. And I keep thinking about my own clinic. I think it's 3 or 4 doctors there, and apparently it's regulated the same way these are, and it's clean, it's safe. Some place that I and thousands of other people go to and feel very trusting of it. It does seem to me that picking this one area out, and given the health department's testimony and so on last couple weeks ago, it does strike me as this is picking out one procedure, and when the department says, well, they think it's going to be hotly contested because of this issue, I can guarantee you it is, because that seems why this bill was picked out in the first place. Because I remember those stories about that Pennsylvania place, and I hope none of our clinics, whether abortion clinics or doctor clinics or whatever kind of clinics we have, I hope there's no facility in Minnesota like that. Since this is regulated the way most, pretty much the way I would guess most physician clinics, it seems to me it looks like the type of thing that dental clinics and others are. Since those are handled in a similar way, it strikes me that this is taken care of and you're looking for a problem to solve. And I wouldn't say that other than the fact that it's this issue. But when we have track record, I'll guarantee if anything ever goes wrong in one of these clinics and somebody's got an unhealthy dirt or germs or other things that you're concerned about or whatever you said happened in Pennsylvania, I will guarantee you that that will be front page stories here, because there are plenty of people who want to make it that way. But when I go to my medical clinic and know it's regulated the same way as this, I got to say I think this is a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem that is very heavily tied to the abortion issue and not tied to the health and safety of a clinic.
Senator Roble.
Senator Marty, you know, a lot of women, if they do have an abortion and something doesn't go quite right, are not as likely to report. I truly believe that, because they probably don't want people knowing that they had an abortion. There would be many that would rather keep that private, and I think that's some of the risk involved here, is that women aren't as likely to report adverse conditions that they may see or that may affect them through the process of an abortion. And I think that it's incumbent upon us to make sure that there is the cleanliness and the proper procedures being followed, so that they, you know, don't have to worry about that, just the basic health and safety issues, which is why, you know, they said they were bringing abortion, making it legal. And yet if we don't oversee it, I don't know how it's much different than it used to be.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
But we do oversee them. And it's similar, I mean, if you're saying that patient who has a bad thing happen, infection or something like that, isn't likely to report it. I mean, you can make the same argument in many mental health clinic too. Nobody wants people to know they were there. If you see a problem and you report to health department, they'll look into it. I mean, the thing is, people, we're not having problems here. There would be headlines if something like Pennsylvania did. Because it was such an outrageous situation, it made national news. And it's kind of like, you know, when you say we're going to have this heavy regulation or this little bit of regulation, which is strange for a political party that keeps saying we got way too much licensing and too much administrative burden and so on. Well, we don't like somebody. Then they can have more regulation. But, you know, with nursing homes, we have heavy licensing and regulation standards, and yet I see it seems every couple weeks or months in the newspaper some story about something terrible going on in nursing homes. So the regulation doesn't always address the problems, and in this case, we do have a regulatory system, the same as any other medical clinic. And you're saying, well, for this kind of clinic, you know, we want to be extra sure that nobody's doing anything, that there's no spread of infectious disease or anything like that. We're going to make sure of that. And I simply don't think that this is going to solve anything. I think if the word abortion or termination of pregnancy wasn't involved in this, nobody would be talking about it because there hasn't been a problem.
Senator Roblin?
You know, the abortion clinics typically do not provide ongoing care. Most of the follow-up is done at your own family practitioner. And so if someone develops an infection and or other complications, it isn't necessarily, they're not necessarily going back to the abortion clinic to find out what might have happened there that caused it. And, you know, as far as whether or not we've had any incidences like in Pennsylvania, it did make headlines there, but it took a long time. Those practices at that particular clinic had apparently been going on for years. And there is always concern that it could be happening here, and we don't know because there is no inspection. There's no oversight. And so that's why we think it's important to bring this forward.
Okay. Senator Fischbach, are you willing to move the...
Oh, I'm happy. No.
Before I do that, Senator Loring, Roebling, to your knowledge, is this bill going to any other committee besides Finance Committee? Is Judiciary requested?
Oh, it has a data privacy.
Okay.
Indicating that the data would remain private.
So I think the motion would be to send it to Judiciary, but Senator Lurie. To
Judiciary and then on to Finance. Have we, on the Finance issue, and I do have to keep asking you this, do we know what's going to happen with Finance bills? Are they going to come back here with bills that have a financial implication that is under the jurisdiction of our committee, or are we going to be seeing these hit the floor with financial ramifications? We really do deserve an answer to that question.
My understanding from this particular bill is that Senator Roebling's intent is to, the amendment we adopted was to try to neutralize the existing fiscal note. I don't know if that will happen in its entirety or not. As we had the conversation previously, we do expect to get the forecast update this week. I think at that point there will be determination made about to what extent we are going to have a finance bill in this committee. We're not, entirely sure yet. I know the other body has expressed to me a preference to do that. But I just can't give you a clear answer. But perhaps in the next week or so we can clarify what the process is going to be. But is that not correct, that your intention is to do something with the amendment that we just adopted to try to mitigate the fiscal note that we have on this bill?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We'll try and put a figure in here for the fiscal note.
So, Senator Higgins, is your question?
Mr. Chair, I did have a question, or maybe it's just more of a comment. I don't know. It seems like every committee I go to, you know, somebody's saying that we have to get rid of rulemaking, you know, got bills out there to eliminate all rulemaking or suspend rulemaking for 2 years. I guess Senator Roebling, if the bill that suspends all rulemaking for 2 years actually passes and gets signed into law, how are you going to deal with this?
Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I know that particular bill is out there, but it does have a provision in there that we can have rules for health and safety. And I think this would very likely qualify for that. It would fall under that category.
Mr. Chair and,
Sarah Higgins.
And Senator Roebling, you know, if we lived in Pennsylvania, I think, great bill, let's do it, you know. But you've provided no information to us that any clinic in Minnesota is acting in an unhealthy way, is dirty, is contaminated, any of that. And so once again, you know, we're in search of a problem with a, you know, some sort of solution, and we don't see the problem, but we have a solution. And I just think we don't need to go down this road. Our health department and all have, they do the work they need to do, and our clinics are not, we're not Pennsylvania. We're better than that. So I'm going to be voting no.
All right. Sarah Fischbach renews her motion that Senate File 1921 be recommended to pass, refer to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Roebling. Senator Gazelka, are you there? You are. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you and members again. I did try to get on this committee.
Real close.
Well, I think we might have to make you an honorary member. You're here so often, but
just for you, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1912 seeks to require a physician's presence in the same room with a woman who is getting an abortion. I can say I've worked on a number of pieces of legislation to protect the life of the unborn baby as well as the mother, but this legislation focuses primarily on the life of the mother. One of the procedures for an abortion uses a combination of drugs that chemically causes an abortion. Currently in Minnesota, some chemical abortions are performed without a physician physically present. Instead, the physician is watching via webcam from a different city or a different location. These are happening, for example, at the Rochester Planned Parenthood Clinic. I believe this is done in disregard for the health and safety of the woman involved and puts them in a potentially dangerous situation if there are complications from the drug RU486. RU486 is not an aspirin. It's dangerous. We know that there are at least 14 documented deaths from RU486 in the United States alone and many other complications. At least six other states have banned the use of this without a doctor's presence. And for the protection of the woman, I think that we should be requiring that here as well. There is no fiscal note. And, Mr. Chair, I also have with me Harris from Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life to testify as an expert witness.
Ms. Harris, did you want to make some testimony on this bill?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak here today. My name is Jordan Harris, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization with over 70,000 member families and more than 200 chapters across the state dedicated to the single issue of protecting innocent human life. I urge you to pass Senate File 1912. This bill does not outlaw abortion, nor does it prohibit a woman from obtaining a chemical abortion. For those of you who aren't familiar with the chemical abortion, it involves a two-drug combination. The first drug is called RU486, or Mifeprex, and works by essentially starving the unborn child. Then a second drug is taken about 24 hours to 48 hours later, which causes contractions and the expulsion of the unborn child. Most of my comments will be specifically related to the first drug, RU486. Though approved by the FDA in 2000, RU486 is known to be a drug that carries significant risks. Because it is for these safety concerns that RU486 has been banned in Canada, a country with a much more liberal abortion policy. The FDA's approval, however, came with significant restrictions, including that only a physician can administer the drug. In other words, the FDA believed that the drug was dangerous enough and the physician's role important enough that RU486 cannot be obtained from a pharmacy, but only directly from a physician. Since its FDA approval, as Senator Gazelka had mentioned, at least 14 women in the United States have died after taking RU486, and more than 2,200 adverse effects have been reported. Many of these side effects of RU486, including prolonged pain, cramping, heavy bleeding, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and fever, can mask more serious complications such as infection, hemorrhage, and incomplete abortion that can sometimes lead to death. Some of these complications may even mask a ruptured ectopic pregnancy whose symptoms mirror the expected side effects of RU486 and can also lead to death. It is also important to note that a chemical abortion, although an alternative to a surgical abortion, doesn't necessarily avoid surgical intervention. According to earlyoptionpill.com, the website of Danco Laboratories, who is the manufacturer of RU486 in the U.S., 5 to 8% of women will need a surgical procedure to end the pregnancy or to stop heavy bleeding. Currently in Minnesota, some chemical abortions are being performed without a physician physically present in the same room with the woman seeking the abortion. Instead, the woman is being administered the RU486 abortion drug by a physician in a different city using closed-circuit video conferencing, and whom remotely opens a locked drawer which contains the RU486 abortion drug. These webcam abortions are happening at the Rochester Planned Parenthood Clinic. Not only is this revelation shocking, but it shows a real disregard for the health and safety of women, given the especially dangerous complications and risks associated with RU486. When RU486 is administered via webcam, the woman is not able to have the physical exam to verify and ensure that she has no factors making RU486 a potentially deadly procedure for her. Physician involvement, as well as the patient-doctor relationship, is critical in helping to mitigate the risk of very serious complications occurring as a result of taking RU486. Abortion is like no other procedure, as the courts have recognized, because as Justice Potter Stewart, writing for the majority in Harris v. McRae, wrote, abortion is inherently different from other medical procedures because no other procedure involves the purposeful termination of potential life. This legislation before you today seeks to protect women by requiring that a physician be in the same room and in the physical presence of the woman when administering RU486. At least six states, including North Dakota and South Dakota, have already enacted such a law. And other states like Wisconsin are currently working to pass legislation to the same effect. RU486 is a dangerous drug, and the associated risks have the potential to increase without a physician being physically present when administering the drug. Women deserve better than a webcam abortion. For this reason, please support Senate File 1912. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. I do have on my list three other people who wanted to testify. I've got a Dr. James House, a Dr. Carrie Terrell, and Karen Law. Do they want to testify at this point? Would like to go first?
I'm Dr. House.
And please identify yourself for the record. I assume you're not the same Dr. House that we have a television
series. No, sir, I'm the real one.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's my honor to be here today. My name is Dr. James House. I'm a retired professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Minnesota Medical School, but I continue to teach and advise residents and consult with patients at the VA Medical Center. I served as the medical director of telemedicine at Fairview University Hospital as a volunteer for many years, involved in research into the effective use of telemedicine in rural Minnesota. When we started in 1995, the process was very complex and expensive and was considered experimental. At this time, it's been confirmed that the doctor-patient interaction over telemedicine technology is equivalent to a face-to-face visit and is becoming more widely employed in many medical situations and has been shown to be particularly valuable for persons in rural areas. I'm here to testify of the importance of telemedicine in the 21st century and to urge you to not place into statute a law that would ban any medical procedure using telemedicine as presented in SF 1912. Telemedicine technology has made it possible for a physician to provide needed medical consultation and make appropriate treatment decisions without requiring the person to travel to the hospital or clinic for evaluation. I will briefly present examples of the use of telemedicine to help you better understand its efficacy. In the emergency management of a stroke patient, a proper diagnosis is essential to allow the administration of life-saving clot buster drugs, which can only be given in the case of a stroke caused by a blood clot to the brain, but not when there is bleeding into the brain. Consultation over telemedicine has been used successfully, enabling a neurology specialist many miles away to evaluate a patient in a rural emergency room to provide the needed expert opinion so that life-saving treatment can be given safely. Telemedicine has been particularly useful in child psychiatry, enabling timely consultation with children in rural areas of the state where the needed specialists are unavailable and long delay could prove harmful. Telemedicine counseling visits with the child facilitates important treatment decisions, including the administration of drugs for managing their condition. Telemedicine is also employed by the VA hospital at many sites for intensive care units. And if you happen to see the Minneapolis Star Tribune today, there's a whole big front page article on the success of telemedicine in facilitating emergency assessment and treatment advice in emergency rooms. And the VA is active in also using telemedicine in the providing psychological counseling of veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and to make important treatment decisions regarding the use of various medications. Since many medications have been used and need to be prescribed via telemedicine, when the physician cannot be in the room with the person, to restrict the prescription of one type of medication, as proposed in this statute, would set an inappropriate precedent. I'll be happy to respond to any questions you might have on telemedicine, and I have copies of my testimony if anyone would like.
All right. Thank you, Dr. House. I think we'll let the other testifiers present, and we'll take any questions that the committee may have. Dr. Carrie Terrell, I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carrie Terrell, and I'm a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist licensed in Minnesota. I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and I'm the director of two clinics, Women's Health Specialists and Whole Women's Health Twin Cities. When medical termination of pregnancy is performed with mifepristone, also called Mifeprax, its brand name, or RU486, in conjunction with misoprostol, efficacy rates are 92 to 98%. Mifepristone is an antiprogestin, and misoprostol is a synthetic prostaglandin. Side effects are generally mild and can include nausea and diarrhea. Uterine cramping, vaginal bleeding are expected effects of the regimen. Serious side effects are rare, occurring in less than 0.1% of cases. It is required that women entering into the protocol have a documented intrauterine gestation, have a detailed understanding of the protocol, understand the risks, signs, and symptoms of potential complications, and have access to an emergency room. Legal-induced abortion is markedly safer than childbirth. In an article published in February of this year in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, it was concluded, the risk of death associated with childbirth is approximately 14 times higher than that with abortion. In 2005, the World Health Organization added mifepristone to its list of essential medicines, thereby endorsing extensive research that the medicines are, quote, effective, safe, and convenient in inducing medical abortion until 9 weeks gestation. Other substances on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines include lidocaine, morphine, and oxygen. Additionally, it is important to remember that we use these protocols to treat other conditions other than the termination of pregnancy. We use them in conditions like corneal pregnancies, quote-unquote C-section scar pregnancies, cervical pregnancies, tubal pregnancies, and miscarriages. These conditions are often desired, wanted pregnancies that have complications. These complications substantially threaten damage to a major bodily function. These conditions are preferentially treated with medicines, not surgery, because these medical protocols offer the best chance to preserve the fallopian tubes and uteri in these women. In light of a recent methotrexate shortage, which is also used to treat similar conditions, we were using more Mifeprex. Both methotrexate and Mifeprex are administered by nursing staff without a physician in the room. Legal limitations on our ability to treat our patients by the best evidence-based protocols is not about patient safety. It is an intrusion on our ability to provide the best possible care for our patients.
Thank you, Dr. Terrell. Karen Law?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Law, and I'm the Executive Director of ProChoice Resources. ProChoice Resources is a local nonprofit. We provide comprehensive sexuality education. We train teachers across the state, and we also provide abortion funding for women in need. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate file number 1912. Make no mistake, this bill is not about protecting women or saving lives. We understand the strategies at play here. This is a whittling away at abortion access for women. Telemedicine uses webcams and other electronic technology to connect doctors with other medical personnel and the patient at remote locations. It has been used for years to bring specialist health care to people who live in remote areas and who do not have access to a provider. As of 2008, 95% of Minnesota counties had no abortion provider. 62% of Minnesota women live in these counties. The intention of this bill is clear. It creates an unnecessary barrier for women who do not live in areas where an abortion provider practices. Women will have to travel hundreds of miles, which is not in her best interest or safety, to access a medical procedure that is her constitutionally protected right. This adds to the cost of abortion care, particularly for rural women and many low to moderate income women who cannot afford the additional travel costs, time off of work, and it continues to create disparities in access between those who can and cannot afford safe and legal abortion services. An abortion via telemedicine gives women the ability to decide what's best for her and her family. If you are truly concerned about women's health and safety regarding this procedure, I will hope you will do your due diligence and read all of the research. Research which, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in 2001, concludes the provision of medical abortion through telemedicine is effective and acceptability high among women who choose this model. Acceptability meaning no increased adverse reactions to women receiving this type of care. The continued restrictions in access to abortion care and making the procedure harder to obtain does not improve women's health. In fact, you are harming our most vulnerable populations, poor women, rural women, women in domestic violence situations, and women of color, people in communities you represent. This bill is erroneous, and with it, you are continuing to usurp women's fundamental rights, the autonomy of doctors and nurses and other medical providers to provide safe, legal abortion care to all women. Simply, with this bill, you are risking the welfare of women, not protecting them. To members of this committee, I respectfully ask that you vote against Senate file number 1912. Thank you. And I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Law. Questions from the committee? Sir Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment and then a question. I am actually a registered nurse, and I have worked with telemedicine, and I think we're going down a dangerous path here. We actually scrapped telemedicine. This is a number of years ago in our hospital because it was untenable, and it was hard to have a nurse standing in a room with a doctor 50, 60, 100, 200 miles away and trying to diagnose and treat and then putting a lot of responsibility on me. And me, as a registered nurse, you know, just set aside my pro-life stance. Me as a registered nurse would not be comfortable administering being the nurse standing in the room when the drawer flips open and the patient is administered this medicine. You're putting a lot of responsibility on me. That's my comment. But I do have a question for Dr. House and Dr. Terrell. Do either of you work at a facility that provides abortions, or are you yourself a provider of abortions on a regular basis?
I am not.
Dr. House.
I am not.
Dr. Terrell?
I do.
Thank you.
Other questions from members of the committee? Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think probably Dr. Terrell would be the best. One of the things that the earlier testifier had said was that this drug, RU486, was actually banned in Canada. That was not my understanding. I didn't hear you address that. Could you tell us more about the status of this drug in Canada? Because I know it, the World Health Organization has strongly recommended the use of this, and it's been – so maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Canadian.
Dr. Terrell?
Well, I don't practice in Canada, but I have read a little bit about it. In 1995, the Minister of Health in Canada did enact a policy that abortion is medically necessary and that all provinces should provide it. And they do provide medical and surgical abortion. Currently, their medical abortions are performed with methotrexate, which, again, can work. It's less effective than mifepristone. Apparently, to have a drug the equivalent of FDA-approved in Canada, the drug approval process has to be requested by a pharmaceutical company. And to date, the pharmaceutical company in question has not done that. So a physician cannot request the approval, patients cannot request the approval, the pharmaceutical company has to go through those hoops. Now, as to why they haven't done that, I don't know. There have been many theories put forward, some of which may include lack of financial incentive or political bias.
Senator Lori?
Okay, but I guess a comment following up on that. I guess then that the idea that, I mean, the idea that we were led to believe was that it was banned in Canada because of safety concerns, that doesn't seem to jive with the description that you just gave us. So.
Correct, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have two questions. One is, a webcam. If you're putting something out in the air, how much of concern about privacy do we have for something like that?
Right. These
Dr. Hulse.
Pardon me, Senator Hall. The telemedicine experience that we have had has gone from highly dedicated T1 lines, station to station, all the way down to current technology on a personal computer with encryption. And so it's currently possible to use a good desktop computer with complete privacy by encrypted networks.
Okay.
Senator Hall?
And if I could have another one. I guess my coming from my background as a minister, I look at presence as being really important. I do death notifications and things like that. I look at this... and I think it's too easy to give permission without being there yourself to see what's been done and what you've done. And that concerns me. I think a caring presence is probably really top importance. And, I was trying to think of, this probably isn't a good example, but it's like maybe our governor giving the state of the state from a Florida golf course. It just doesn't feel right. So I would be in favor of this bill.
Are there other questions from members of the committee? I had one question for, I don't know which of the witnesses might respond to this, but the practice of administering this RU486 through a telemedicine process, how long has that been going on? How long have we had that practice in Minnesota?
I don't know how long we've had it in Minnesota. I only know in Iowa it's been since 2008.
I don't think that was a comment on my question.
I'm sorry. She didn't like my response. I'm sorry.
Right. I guess the only reason I was asking that, I know there was some testimony about the presumed burden that this change in law would make, and I was just trying to understand whether this was a practice that had been longstanding in Minnesota that this would represent a change from, or whether this is something that has very recently occurred. But if nobody knows, I guess nobody can answer that question. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try and explain my experience with telemedicine. And keep in mind that I resigned from the hospital I worked at in 2003. I think it was 2003. I still hold a current nursing license. It must have been in the late 90s or early 2000s that we tried a telemedicine experiment in our hospital in rural Minnesota. And we live, the Perham Hospital is about 70 miles from the big Metropolis Hospital. It was then called Merit Care, now Sanford. And they had the original, I guess my original thought on telemedicine was doctors talking directly to doctors. They could share x-rays and tests and so on. And what they tried to do in Perham was they tried to get us, the nurses, to be handling the stethoscopes and all the different equipment that we had to use to try and diagnose patients. It was untenable. And we finally, a group of us finally went to our management and said, you can't do this. The ER visits were 2 and 3 hours long for a sore throat. And a number of us told management, if you're going to put this kind of responsibility on nurses, then you better start paying us as advanced practice nurses, because they were stepping over the line of our practice. And I see this kind of a bill as doing the same thing to nurses. I think no matter where you are in the pro-life industry pro-choice, this is a liability to anybody who's standing in the room without a doctor present. And I just have huge concerns. Like I said, set aside my pro-life stance, but I have huge concerns as a registered nurse on the liability that this is creating when the doctor's not there, when they're talking over a TV, and then treatment is being administered. And this drug does not come without some grave side effects. And one life is one too many in my book.
Right. Thank you. Senator Lori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman, thanks for the caveat that this was back in the 90s, and telemedicine was just beginning to be developed. I think it's come to some really beneficial uses for people in rural areas. I serve an incredibly rural area too, and I know it's being used by mental health clients across Minnesota, that we have a real shortage of a lot of the mental health providers that we need around the state. Dr. House testified about the use for our veterans suffering from PTSD. I mean, there's many. The Mayo is using it for stroke victims. I mean, there's many, many, many really legitimate and incredibly valuable services being offered today to people all across this state that are benefiting tremendously. And so turning this into an attack on telemedicine is a dangerous thing to be doing. It's really working well for a lot of patients. The results are coming back with really high responses in terms of customer satisfaction. I mean, I think that turning this into an anti-telemedicine is probably unwarranted. We're really making phenomenal strides, and I really appreciate the testimony of Dr. House, and I'm really worried about the ramifications of turning this into saying that telemedicine should just go by the wayside, because I think that it is just really beginning to demonstrate its true value, and to be curtailing it in this manner is unwarranted at this point.
Thank you, Senator Lori. Senator Gesell, do you want to return to the – I think we're – close to taking action on your bill, and maybe you want to return to the thank you witnesses. And Senator Lori, my own opinion, and it may be different than others, but I don't know that this is necessarily a broad indictment of telemedicine, at least in my view. It wouldn't be. I think that there may be some procedures or some instances where a telemedical approach may not be appropriate. I think what I'm hearing is that the argument is that in this particular case that may not be the right case to apply it, but I don't know that that's a general indictment of telemedicine. I don't know, Senator Gesell, do you have any comment on that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Courts in Minnesota have recognized that abortion is different than other medical procedures because no other procedure involves the purposeful termination of potential life. And in Minnesota statute, surgical abortion requires a physician presence. And so this bill would include that requirement for chemical abortions, linking those two.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, following up on what Senator Lori said, yes, I understand this is not overall intended to go after telemedicine. I think Senator Hoffman's comments made it sound like telemedicine was bad, period, and so on. I think this bill is in very many ways similar to the previous bill. It's focused on, because we're dealing with abortion, we want to put extra burdens, extra problems in the way. And if it is, because there are risks for taking a medication like this, that we've got to make sure the physician is present. I see that the risk of associated death from mifepristone, RU486, easier to say, one out of 100,000 prescriptions. Viagra, it's five out of 100,000. I want to hear somebody come here and suggest we ought to have physician presence required when Viagra is administered. But that's the whole point. I mean, we're taking one thing and we're deciding because it has abortion related to it, we're going to make sure a physician is present. We're going to make sure we deal with the clinics and have some more licensing standards and everything else. No other physician clinic is going to have that, just these ones. No other drug, even ones that are maybe five times as risky for death or other things. We're not going to have physicians required for them, but for this one, yeah. I think that's the whole point. These bills are aimed at one procedure that I understand that people do not like. It's a legally available option to people. It's certainly a lot less risky than full-term pregnancy is, and I'm not saying that we don't watch that carefully, but I think we've got safe procedures here. We're trying to say that, oh, in Canada, I mean, that earlier discussion, I wasn't that familiar with it, saying that, oh, it's been banned in Canada, and then we say, well, it hasn't been approved there because nobody ever submitted it for approval. I mean, that's a whole different issue. I think this is trying to pick out one area and trying to put extra burdens in the way, which you can fight it out in court, but I frankly think that a lot of women have gotten good care at these clinics. I think that in this particular bill, when physicians are coming in and saying that doing this through telemedicine works and it's safe, that's the way we ought to do it. And again, when somebody comes in with a bill to say you have to have the physician present for Viagra administration, then I'll take this one seriously.
Well, thank you, Senator Marty. I don't know anything about Viagra, but does our witness want to make a comment on this?
I'm not, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to be commenting on Viagra either. However, I do have a few things that I wanted to clear up. First, I would be happy to provide with the committee the information about Canada and the status of RU486 in Canada. I'd be happy to do that. Second, a lot of the testifiers were talking a lot about how telemedicine is really great in providing consultations and able to provide treatments and follow-up care for people with strokes and things like that. We certainly agree. Telemedicine can be used for a lot of great things, but pregnancy isn't a disease that needs treating. And nothing in this bill prevents any woman from having a chemical abortion. If women's health is that important, and this is such a main focus of women's health, then all that would need to happen is that a physician be on site while these chemical abortions were being administered. Nothing says that women can't have a chemical abortion. If it's that important and central to women's health, then while it may be a little bit more expensive or not as cost-effective for Planned Parenthood or others, they would just need to have a provider on location in Rochester or wherever else they plan on doing these webcam abortions. And finally, there was a question as to how long have these been going on in Minnesota. Well, actually, last fall of 2011, Planned Parenthood had come out and said they had started doing these abortions in Rochester. So I just wanted to offer that information to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That was one of my questions, how long the distant administration of this drug had been going on, and what you're suggesting has been less than 6 months that this has been potentially been happening.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is not, from our understanding, a long-standing policy that's really become, you know, the way it's been done. This is fairly new.
All right. Senator Hoffman, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something that I heard from Senator Marty and Senator Lori. Number one, I wasn't inferring that telemedicine was bad in all cases. I was speaking specifically about asking a nurse to perform procedures that normally a doctor would perform. That's what I was speaking to. It didn't work. The nurses that I worked with and me didn't like it. It put a lot of liability on us, and that's what I was speaking to. I was in no way vilifying telemedicine, and it's not a useful tool in treating medical conditions such as mental illness or whatever other things that we're doing. But we're talking about procedures. We're not talking about counseling and a face-to-face talk. We're talking about a procedure that has potential for life-threatening effects. And I think that we have to take some of those things a little bit more serious than just a drawer popping open and a nurse is in the room and a pill comes out and we all go on our merry way. That was my point.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
Well, I think that we're going off on a lot of different components of the way in which the future is going to run in terms of how we manage health care and how we contain the cost of health care. Telemedicine is one of those. But I would just speak from also from a nursing perspective that one of our goals in health care reform is that people work to the highest level of their license within their scope of practice. And that I would agree with Senator Hoffman to the degree that, as you know, there are different levels of preparation for RNs as well as for mid-level practitioners in terms of their abilities and their capacity to partner in the medical profession to execute very complicated and life-threatening situations, and that we should be promoting that, not discouraging that, while honoring that if there is a nurse that does not feel they have competencies, that they would certainly not be asked to move into an activity beyond their scope of practice. And that is not just in relationship to this bill, but in general. We need to be careful also. I would like to respond to the idea that that we not perpetuate this hierarchical model of healthcare in which the only caring person or the only competent person to carry out a procedure is the physician, because that is inaccurate, and there is much science and research to show that mid-level practitioners are able to perform procedures, very complicated procedures, and use telecommunications for urgency situations where the outcomes are as good, if not sometimes better.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 1921 be to pass and go on to judiciary, correct?
Right.
Is that where it's going next? I missed the beginning of the...
That's all right. Thank you. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1912 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Committee. Seeing no debate on that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Gazelka, and testifiers. And members, that concludes our agenda for today. I appreciate your attendance and contribution, and we are adjourned.